world tomorrow. Garner Ted Armstrong brings you the plain truth about today's world views and the prophecies of the world tomorrow.
This is my fine Swiss watch. I use it to help me go where I'm going when I'm in an airplane. Now, if I took this watch and smashed it to bits with a great big 9-pound sledgehammer and tossed all the little bits and pieces in a box and then began to, well, I'd have to get an automatic shaker because I'd wear my arms out, and then shook this thing, all these pieces, how many millions of years do you think it would take for this to become a watch again, all wound up and running? Right now, the way the thing looks, it could be even monitoring my liver. It looks like it's doing more than just telling time. Well, it does a little bit more than that, but not really very much. But it's a fairly good analogy, a fairly good question to ask. How many millions of aeons would it take before all those pieces kind of repaired themselves, put themselves together again, and became a watch? Well, you know, it's easier for you to believe that than it is for you to believe in evolution. To believe that organic living creatures evolved, to believe in a series of miracles that are far more miraculous than any miracles you have to believe in God, you know, begin to wonder, what is this anti-supernaturalistic bias or this embarrassment that makes people a little bit embarrassed to think maybe God created everything that is, but not a bit embarrassed to think they came from seaweed? When you go through your family album, you point out to people you had a grandfather. If you went all the way back to your zillionth grandfather, what would he look like? An amoeba? People are a little bit embarrassed about whether or not there is a God. Well, let me tell you something. There is time yet remaining in this world for you to take up God on his challenge. Prove me now herewith. Prove all things. Hold fast that which is good. Right now, you've got time. In a little while, God will prove himself to you. But right now, you have plenty of time to experiment around, think about it, look at it, take a look at what science says, and find out whether or not you can, technically, and even using the tools of science, prove whether or not there is a God. There are actual 7 proofs I've been going through. The fact of immutable laws that demand a lawgiver. The fact of life that demands a life giver. The fact of there being a creation of matter, and the fact that there is no past eternity of matter that requires a creator to any rational mind. And the fact of the sustaining of this creation by kind reproducing after kind, like kind, that produces after its own kind. This is not something that just is stretching a point to come up with some biblical argument, some theological answer for inexplicable things of science as opposed to religion. These are immutable, incontrovertible absolutes. There is no reasoning around them. Those proofs stand. They are real proofs. They're not just guesses. Now, the 5th major proof that there is a God is merely the proof of design requiring a designer. I want to give you a couple of 3 quotations about that. First of all, the 104th Psalm, there's an interesting scripture there. How manifold, it says, are your works in wisdom. Doesn't mean dumb, blind, happenstance, chance with a capital C, nature with a capital N. In wisdom have you made them all, the world is full of your riches. Well, you know, not all scientists reject the idea of there being a God. Here's from a book called Nature's Wonders by Robert S. Lemon. And I quote his words, "Nature's world is peopled by no random assemblage of isolated, unrelated forms of life jumbled together without rhyme or reason. Rather, it's an inconceivably vast and integrated organization, a network composed of myriads of vital, connecting strands. It is an interdependent nature that we see all about us." Really, every one of these things disproves evolution all by itself. For example, the very fact of there being creatures that exist only because another creature exists. In other words, completely separate, fully developed, that's a nice word, but anything that survives is obviously fully developed. A creature that exists only because it serves or in some way helps another living creature to exist. There are such things. There are cleaner fish that swim right in and out of the mouths of other fish and take parasites away from them. Even human beings that have to have bacteria in their own bodies to digest their food. The same thing is true of the milk you drink that comes from a cow. Unless you've got it all broken down, boiled, made so the cream won't even rise, and that's another subject entirely. Here's one from a book on life, nature, library, ecology, and it says it's virtually impossible to pluck out of a single food chain from a community, since each link in the chain has living links leading back to other animals and plants. As one examines a food chain in terms of animals and plants that constitute it, that's all the way then from tiny microorganisms to insects on up to bigger creatures and the man, if you take anything out, it soon becomes apparent that these forms can be arranged into what is called a pyramid, a food pyramid. Everything is interrelated. Each depends upon the other being there. Hear from the same source on the forest, and I quote, "The forest swarms with insects, mammals, birds, reptiles, and amphibians. The numbers of all these members of the community are in delicate balance and tied to each other by invisible threads of food, living conditions, and mutual cooperation. This multitude of life does not merely live in the forest. It is the forest as much as the trees themselves. So the whole thing is like a living, pulsating organism." The same source says, "So intricate is the tapestry of forest life that should a single vital thread somehow be broken, the entire pattern might unravel, and ultimately the forest itself be destroyed." These are larger cases. The case of the universe, the solar system, the earth and all life upon it, the seas around us. But, you know, let's take just one individual case of one bird, which is a very interesting bird. You can have it in the brochure we'll tell you about the woodpecker. He's a specially built, different kind of a bird, an amazing one, and the woodpecker all by himself gives evolutionists quite a headache. Now, you'd have a headache, too, if you spent your life banging your brains out against a good hard chunk of wood. First and most obvious that is different about a woodpecker is its beak. It's straight, it's very hard in comparison with most other birds, and pointed. The head is constructed differently. The skull is much thicker than that of other birds. The skull and the beak are moved sometimes more than 100 times a minute, this one a little more slowly, but sometimes very, very rapid with staccato-like powerful hammering motions by powerful, strong muscles. And the bones between the beak and the skull have their own built-in shock absorbers to take all that jolting, banging against wood. They're constructed differently. Every part of the woodpecker's anatomy is specially constructed for the sole purpose of drilling into wood. For example, the tongue is different. It actually wraps clear around the head and comes into one nostril, believe it or not, but the tongue is long. Most woodpeckers have a very bony-like tip, including razor-sharp little hooks on the end of the tongue, and it's covered with a very sticky substance, so they can probe inside the crack or the hole in the wood that they're banging on and take an insect out of it. They got two downward claws and two upward, just like ice tongs, and the tail, very, very stiff, that acts as a brace that steadies the bird on like a firm tripod as it whacks away at the wood. The tail feathers in woodpeckers are unusually strong, and during molting season, the main propping feathers don't fall out until the others have already been in there to replace them, so they molt little by little. Now, most people think that a woodpecker kind of picks up an insect with its beak, more or less like many other birds, but it doesn't. It bangs away, and then it inserts that tongue into the hole it's banged in the tree and gets out an unsuspecting ant. As a matter of fact, some woodpeckers have tongues that resemble a worm. So they'll bang away at a hole, they'll stick their tongue way deep in the hole and let it lie there a minute. The insects begin to think it's a worm. They attack the worm, and only to find out they're taking a quick ride into a woodpecker's mouth, that it wasn't a worm after all, but a woodpecker's tongue. Contrary to some popular opinion, woodpeckers, with the one exception of one kind out of the many, many kinds there are, do not damage trees. Only the sapsucker does that. The rest of them actually aid and help. In a moment, I'll come back and show you why that's such a headache to evolution. There are a lot of very serious questions that evolution simply cannot answer.
One question that has bothered man for centuries probably has bothered you too. Average men and great philosophers alike have struggled with this monumental problem, and it's a question that needs answering. The question is, does God exist? And if so, how can you prove it? Whether you feel that organized religion is ritual or reality, the question still remains. The free booklet, Does God Exist?, offers tangible information that will help you answer this timeless question. You'll learn how matter, intelligence, and design prove the literal existence of a creator God. There is no greater question that means so much to your own daily life and peace of mind. Does God exist? Now you can know beyond any doubt. Request your free copy of Does God Exist? Dial this toll-free number, 800-423-4444. That's 800-423-4444.
You know, evolution is very, very free with all our guesses, and I think it's fair to guess a little bit once in a while to kind of help evolution along. They've got a problem, and that is, how did the very first woodpecker begin to peck wood? Now, a woodpecker doesn't need to peck wood to survive, you can surmise, because lots of other birds do quite well picking them off the surface of trees, or underneath limbs, or out of the air, or even diving into water with a powerful splash. There are birds, however, that seem to be specialized to do special things so that the entire ecological balance of whether it's shallow ponds or rivers or the sea itself, such as cormorants and so on, all have a certain task to perform. And it's like they didn't even ask permission, like somebody decided all this for them in advance. But you've got to imagine, if you're going to accept evolution, how the very first woodpecker could have evolved. Now, I've seen lots of birds cleaning their beaks on limbs, so maybe you could begin to speculate. One day, somehow, there weren't any other insects that the bird could catch that weren't down inside the wood, so that all there was left were grubs and termites. Now, this doesn't make sense, because if there weren't other kinds of insects around, then none of the living fauna and flora and so on would have survived, because the whole world would have been upset without the insects. But we have to imagine that anyhow, because in order for the woodpecker to evolve into a woodpecker, to survive by pecking wood, to get grubs and insects and ants and so on, termites, outside of wood, there had to be no other food source available. There had to be the stimulus for him to get that food to survive in order to provide some kind of a means for him to go out searching for food to start banging his head against wood. So if you can imagine that, we got to start someplace. So whatever it was doing all the pecking, it wasn't yet a woodpecker, it was a pre-woodpecker. But now, woodpeckers have been observed pecking around on trees and listening. And so science has discovered that woodpeckers have a very, very acute hearing, just like a lot of other birds. You've seen robins jumping around on your lawn. They'll cock their head, they'll listen, they'll run over there and pick up a grub. And there can be a power mower going next door, an airplane going overhead, and cars going by in the street. And somehow those birds are able to tune into a frequency. Slither, slither, slither. Worms are awful quiet the way they crawl. I've never heard a worm crawl in my entire life. I've never even heard one scream. I put a few of them on a hook in fishing, you know, which I don't like to do very often, but sometimes you have to when the bass aren't hitting. So you go after the bream, or the brim, as they call them in Texas. And maybe if worms made noises, you could hear this tiny, you know, but you don't hear it. And you certainly can't hear them crawling, slithering around inside the can. Woodpeckers can. Birds can. They're banging around on a tree, and they hear this hollow sound. And inside, they hear these tiny shrieks of termites, I guess. Woodpecker outside. But anyhow, they stop, and they begin to whack away, and they drill a hole into the tree, and sure enough, they hit it every time. They don't go through knots. They don't go through hard wood spots where there's nothing in there. They peck around till they find out where those insects are going to be, and then they peck right down to them. Now, how do they develop that kind of an apparatus? They can't see through wood, but they can hear. They can hear those hollow sounds, and they know where the insects are. They can hear them moving around inside. The very first woodpecker, though, had to know that before he had the specialized equipment. Now, when he started pecking away, he didn't yet have claws where he could walk straight up and down. Sometimes they walk down, believe it or not. So every time he tried to peck, he took one whack and fell over backwards and died of a broken neck. Or, let's say that the first time he tried to brace himself, his tail feathers bent, and he broke them, and he fell down tumbling, and then he took off to fly and kept flying in circles until he got dizzy and flamed out and broke his neck on a twig, because he didn't have stiff tail feathers yet where he could jam them into a tree. If you took most tail feathers of a bird, there are a lot of indignant birds walking around this world without tail feathers. They want to put them in some woman's hat. And if you simply took those away, the birds can't fly straight. It's just like cutting the horizontal stabilizer off an aircraft. Something dramatic is going to happen. A bird has to have those tail feathers on there. And fortunately for the woodpecker, when molting comes, that doesn't happen to ladies' hats, thankfully, but we still use feathers and everything, and birds molt. Feathers drop out, but one by one in an order. They don't all just drop out all at once. The bird stands there naked for 6 months waiting for the feathers to go back in. I remember my kid one time asked me about a man who was directing an orchestra, and he was bald, at least along the top, and he had a little bit of hair on the sides, as I recall. And my kid at that time was much younger, my son. He leaned over and he said, "What happened to Mr. So-and-so's hair?" And I said, "You know, the orchestra's performing, hacking away on the violin. This guy waving a stick at him, telling him shut up, but they wouldn't do it." And so
I said, hush, you know, it all fell out. And the kid looked at me and said, all at once? Well, thankfully, most people don't lose their hair that way. But, you know, birds don't even, they don't have a problem. They just keep replacing it. Men, they look at the ad and say, I can make hair grow. And I guess they try those ads. I don't know just how successful they are. I remember a lot of guys were using real strong peppery substance, kept the refrigerator and rubbed it on their head and went around with about 110 degree temperature or something like that, just trying to stimulate hair. But birds don't have to stimulate those feathers. They don't have to worry about it. One big song and falls out, but it won't fall out until there's another one right there pushing it out. Just like baby teeth, you know, making way for the big ones underneath, except that this happens every single year. The birds replace those feathers once a year minimum, and some of them up to three times a year. Some of them for mating purposes and for recognition as well as just to get dry feathers. But how did it all begin? Feathers could not have evolved from a loosely hanging frayed scale, as I showed last time. It simply is illogical, irrational, and it doesn't make sense. When you write for this brochure we've talked to you about, you will see some of these very embarrassing questions put to evolutionists in the best way that our research department can possibly do it. And you have to imagine what would happen the very first time a would-be woodpecker began to pick a tree to bang his head against, but without the very specialized equipment, almost like a hard hat with a power drill, with a pair of ice tongs for feet and a powerful tripod to sit upon. For thousands of years then, maybe these birds flew wildly about, banging their head against trees and breaking their necks. Well, they didn't have that very absorbent cushion there between the beak and the head to absorb the shock, or they didn't have that kind of an ice tong like grip, or they didn't have those powerful feathers to brace themselves against the tree. They didn't have a specialized tongue or specialized hearing. They didn't have that specialized powerful beak and a hard bony head, different from other birds. So can you imagine it? The first woodpecker took the first whack at a tree, got his beak stuck in a crack, and starved to death. So he didn't survive, so there aren't any. But they did survive, so there are some. All right, well, fine. Well, a second woodpecker broke his neck the first time he banged his head into an ash or a hickory or an oak tree. So he doesn't exist. Others were flying wildly about, dizzy with headaches and crashing into trees at full flight, you know. And they were lying there in the forest floor, kind of on their backs, dying. But, you know, they had to obtain all those grubs inside those trees to survive. The only reason for them developing the special equipment was so they could survive. But other birds are doing quite well picking the grubs off grass and off the exterior of the trunks. And they don't need all that special equipment, and they're surviving, aren't they? So why not evolve into a wren or a thrush or even a screech owl? Anything but a woodpecker. It's the toughest way to earn your living you can begin to imagine.
There's a new Europe coming. From the days when Europe was reduced to rubble at the end of World War II, the plain truth has been predicting its rebirth as a world power. As this European bloc develops independently of the United States and Russia, the plain truth keeps you informed with advance articles. And now, as the European common market emerges economically and politically to shake the world, the plain truth brings you the dramatic story behind Europe's return to power. With articles like Cracks in the Atlantic Alliance and Who Speaks for Europe, the plain truth helps you keep ahead of events in this fast-moving world. The plain truth, after 40 years, still ahead of its time. Dial this toll-free number, 800-423-4444. That's 800-423-4444.
Evolution has a whale of a tale to tell about the toothed whales and dolphins, and you know, the most scientific explanations you can read for it are some of the funniest things you can ever read. Let me show you just one of them. This is out of a book about the living world of the sea. Now, the man's sincere, and these are intelligent men, but you know, when it gets down to explaining how all this happened in these short periods of time, like 50 million years or so, one paragraph will suffice. And then we just go on and talk about how marvelous the creatures are. If you real quickly tell some unsuspecting child in school, a few million years ago, thus and such happened, and then you get down to the marvels of how intricately, harmoniously, and delicately balanced are all their systems, how complex are their various mechanisms for survival, how big they are, how fast they are, how they can go down 1,000 feet below the surface of the ocean and navigate down there in absolute pitch blackness, and how their body is built to allow them to dive to such depths and come up instantly without getting the bends as would happen to a human diver, and how they've got a layer of skin that is just like soaked rug over which, you know, you can't even get water to splash with a hose if you soak it up, that they move through the water a lot more rapidly. And yet they're warm-blooded, air-breathing mammals that give birth to their children upside down so they don't come with their blowhole out too soon and drown in the process, that suckle their young. Oh, you begin to, you know, explain how marvelous dolphins are, or the Pacific bottlenose porpoise, as he is called. But if you've got that one paragraph in there, millions of years ago, thus and such, then all of this evidence about what a marvelous creature he is seems to be evidence that evolution occurred, when in truth you're hearing proof that evolution could not have happened. Now here's that quotation. Evolutionists say the whale's past is extremely obscure. I'll say it is, because there isn't any fossil life at all to try to demonstrate that whales at one time crawled around on the land and simply decided to go back to the sea. All we know is that sometime, the story goes, some smallish, four-footed land animals began a series of extraordinarily rapid evolutionary changes. Now, extraordinarily rapid evolutionary changes means, as they go on to say, in the geologically short span of 50 million years, they learned to swim instead of to walk. Why did they? How did they? They only swam apparently because there was an urge that they couldn't survive on land. They had to go back to the sea to survive. They sure didn't do it just to play. You know, an otter's a pretty good swimmer. He can catch fish. But during the time that they weren't such good swimmers, they couldn't survive. They had to keep going back to land. Therefore, the strongest impetus was for them to remain on land, wasn't it? Instead of the opposite. Well, let's not get too technical. It says here, they learned to swim instead of walk and to reproduce offspring able to swim from the moment they left the womb. And that's it. But that's only a part of the fantastic story, because the way they tell it, you know what had to happen? These beasts lost their ears and their hind legs, developed a body shaped like a torpedo with a horizontal tail, lost their hair, totally changed their whole metabolism, totally changed their entire skeletal system and bone structure, their skin texture and composition, enlarged their brains, altered their nervous system, changed their entire digestive apparatus, altered their eyes, their teeth, and their ears, and became dolphins and toothed whales. And you ask yourself, is there anything about this creature that you can see is a demonstration that he evolved? Brains bigger than man. They're instinctive, they can be trained, you've got to be trained, you couldn't train a dolphin without some specialist training you to train one. But they're very intelligent, they're very helpful and friendly to man. I don't think there's a case on record in the entire history of dolphins of a dolphin ever attacking a man. I understand there are some cases, I don't know how accurate they are, of dolphins actually helping men to shore. Fables, tradition, all talk of the dolphin, their relationship to man, like the boy on the dolphin. They were even worshipped in pagan times. The Pacific bottlenose dolphins, doing backward somersaults, leaping through hoops. And that's the cover picture, the brochure, that we'll send to you by return mail, absolutely free of charge, that will tell you, some of these questions will be in there, but it'll tell you also a little more technically about dolphins, and it even includes a series of pictures of the sequence of dolphins being born. And it shows you how that is a headache, too, for evolutionists. How on earth could such a thing have occurred over vast periods of time? Is there any fossil evidence for a part dolphin, for one whose nose was just part way up to the top of his head? Is there any evidence for one that had just a partially torpedo-shaped body, or a skin that was only one layer thick, or a bony structure only part developed? You know, the fossil record, since there would be, for every perfectly developed species, a finished and complex creature, the fossil record should be complete. It should show all of the in-betweens, but it does not. It doesn't show all of the many intermediate species. If you had a motion picture frame, an analogy I've given many, many times, of a certain scene that you took in your front yard in a home movie, and you wanted to make a still of it, and then maybe you wanted another one a little later on. Maybe you had one of your baby, and then you took the baby. First, you had no clothes on it, and then you took a picture of the baby fully dressed, and you took one frame and then the other out of a series of about 3 minutes or more of motion picture photography. Well, you would have hundreds of in-between frames that would show all the action that transpired between the total naked scene and the one fully clothed. And, of course, that's only an analogy, but here's the point I want to make. If the creatures that were in between, that gradually developed from one full-fledged, perfectly survivable species into another full-fledged, perfectly survivable species, then I would say it is safe to argue that the intermediate species were nowhere near so equipped to survive. Therefore, they perished at far more prodigious rates than did those which were more equipped to survive. But why doesn't a one of them exist in the fossil record? Why are there no intermediate species? Why are there all of these living fossils? For years, the textbook said the coelacanth was extinct. He was accused of being dead and extinct for many years. And yet here we find, not so long ago, one was caught off the coast of Africa, and they still exist. Now, you hear about Stone Age men learning to use tools. Well, here, not very long ago, there was a tribe, only numbering into the 30s or 40s or whatever it is, in one little isolated part of the jungles of the southern island of the Philippines, Mindanao. And here is a Stone Age society. They were using stone tools, the most rudimentary life you can imagine, eating pollywogs and grubs for their existence, and various vegetable materials. Many of the plants they were living on haven't even been identified by botanists yet. That's how up-to-date science is. Well, now, here we have, on the one hand, space-age man, and on the other hand, a stone-age society living side by side. And the same thing is true of living creatures. I know there are creatures that are extinct, but so what? There are creatures that are becoming extinct even right now today as a result of man's own ecological imbalance. So this colorful brochure, A Theory for the Birds, that I've been announcing, will come to you by return mail free of charge, and it will show you precisely what is wrong with some of the reasoning of evolution. Did the miracle of flight come from frayed, loosely hanging fish scales? Did myriads of birds evolve from ungainly, hulking caimans and crocodiles? Evolutionists say they did, but reason, logic, common sense, and certainly the Bible say they did not. So you write for this free brochure and find out about it for yourself. There are no intermediate species. There isn't anything at all to show you that the idea that birds and crocodiles are the closest living relatives is supposed to be true in the idea of evolution. You write for this very beautiful, colorfully illustrated brochure. It's the same size as the Plain Truth magazine. While you're at it, write for the Plain Truth magazine. It contains a couple of hard-hitting, fast-moving articles every single issue about world conditions in the light of Bible prophecy. But also in the Plain Truth magazine, you'll see articles on Christian living, on the economy, on agriculture, on the growing might of a European economic community, about things you need to know for even household purposes, about safety, about the danger of fire, about economic and financial principles, about government, about education, about crime. It's very carefully researched. It's just what its title implies. It's the Plain Truth, a magazine of real understanding. I hope you'll write for it. We'll send it to you by return mail as soon as you dial that toll-free number, 800-423-4444. Or you can write to me, Garner Jed Armstrong, Pasadena, California. All we ask is that you tell us the call letters of your radio station. And then the address will be repeated again in just a moment. Until next time, I'm going to take you on a trip in a jet and tell you a little bit about bird migration. Until then, this is Garner Jed Armstrong saying goodbye, friends.
You have heard The World Tomorrow with Garner Jed Armstrong. Sponsored by the Worldwide Church of God. For literature offered on this program, send your requests along with the call letters of this station to Garner Ted Armstrong, Pasadena, California, 91123. Or you may dial this toll-free number, 800-423-4444.